Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 197.JU0112, certificate number 26039. The Cavendish Banana.
Come, Mr. Tallyman, tally me banana.
Will I come and me wander home?
Come, Mr. Tallyman, tally me banana.
Will I come and me wander home?
Would you like a banana?
I always want a banana.
They're a little green. I like greenish bananas, but my daughter will only eat borderline brown.
I like them green.
We have a good ecosystem.
My dad believed that bananas had power.
Yeah, they do. Potassium.
And so,
or did he mean some kind of mystical power?
No, he meant potassium, but he also meant, I think...
What if every time someone said power, they meant potassium? Like, what if white power meant white potassium?
Power! White potassium.
Potassium to the people.
He would eat a banana under almost any circumstances, and if you were leaving the house in the morning or at any point on your way somewhere, he would say, have a banana, he would say. And it became a kind of shibboleth for my sister and me. We say, have a banana, as a way of saying, you know, charge the day, go get the world. Like, it's, you
get
know,
out there.
It's up to you. Get out there. Have a banana. So a banana.
Is the banana in this metaphor life?
It is.
The day, take life in your teeth?
Well, it's power. Like, it's giving you a power up.
Oh, it's like a boost.
Yeah, to have a banana. And it's also a way of, like, integrating our father, who passed away many years ago, into our daily lives. And so now I say it to my daughter, and she has begun to believe that bananas have power, too.
I was thinking about this the other day, and I think a lot of moms are, and you know, a lot of parents do say the equivalent of have a banana, but I think bananas are kind of coasting on just the fact that, like oranges, this is maybe a too hot a take for even this show, I'm going to get letters. Bananas and oranges are not the best fruit, but they just have convenient wrappers.
They do. You can put one in a bag.
So really, almost anyone, maybe I'm not normal, but I would rather have an apple or a nectarine or grapes. There's any number of fruits I'd rather have.
When you say not the best fruits, what is that based on? What do you mean, not the best fruits?
I just don't enjoy a banana that much.
It's fine. You don't prefer them, but it's not like their quality of as a fruit is like somehow.
You want me to have some objective set of, yeah, I've ranked every fruit on 5 different axes.
Let me ask you, does a nectarine have power?
It's getting juice all over my face.
Yeah.
Don't you think that's a kind of power? It's a kind of raw fecundity.
It's the wrong kind of power. It's the kind of power that suggests that you've been like, making out with someone in the back of a car at a hot rod movie theater.
Do you think maybe your obsession with the powerful nature of a banana is a little problematic? That it's a little masculine, it's a little phallic.
I don't know. The thing about a banana is that, as fruits go, it's pretty dry.
See, that's what I'm saying.
But it doesn't, you know, like all that fruit moisture. It lends itself to so much. I don't know, dripping and.
Technically, a banana is a berry, I think.
Oh,
because the seeds are in there. But you know, unlike a berry, it's kind of dry and pasty.
Yeah. A banana.
There are whole continents that just use bananas for baking, basically, you know, like it's a staple of,
sure.
It's a starchy staple of your average
mush
East African dinner.
I feel like one of the main advantages to a banana is that you don't have to wash it. because there aren't any bugs on it.
That's what I'm saying. Oranges and bananas are sealed by in nature's own Ziploc.
Nature's own Ziploc.
But I think I'm wrong about, well, I don't know. Either that's very convincing or I'm just wrong about the appeal of the banana, because the average American eats 27.
Was that a pun? Was that a pun? Is that something I'm going to get yelled at by somebody that I didn't ring a bell?
I can't believe Ken didn't say it. And then when I say it, I can't believe John didn't.
Okay. He said it has appeal.
I'll have to try not to say appeal again. The average American eats 27 pounds of bananas a year.
What? No way. A 27 day. pounds.
Every single day. No, a year.
Does that count? Is that like T-bone pounds where it counts the bone?
Oh, like, I'm getting a, no.
Like a pound of bananas, does it include the peels? Because the peels are heavy. They're one of the heaviest peels.
That's a good question. And our particular, you know what? Banana peels used to be heavier, as we shall see. Banana peels have gotten lighter since our... Since our parents' day, since your dad used to have a banana. Do you ever peel a banana, by the way, the right way? Have you heard about this?
I peel it from the bottom, like a monkey.
You peel it from the blossom?
Yes.
I don't think I've ever done that. I always do a little break here, but they say you might snap the banana.
It depends on whether or not I have a knife. If I have a knife, I cut it up at the stalk. I just make a quick incision,
here near
right there,
the...
and then I'm able to peel it easily. But if I'm just given a banana out in the wild... If I pull one down from a tree, I open it from the bottom.
I'm trying this for the first time.
And look at it. It went so easily.
It is pretty good. The problem is it doesn't really let you get rid of this little... So I hate this little nubbin or nipple thing on top of the banana.
Everybody hates it.
But I feel like it's more likely... Like if you do it this way, you can kind of pinch. And when you pull the banana out...
It's a thing that you have to practice. But if you do it right, you can pull the...
They say you're going to get less of the strings, but look, I got a string right here, and I hate the strings.
Well, I don't mean that.
I had a gag reflex as a kid from banana nipples and banana strings.
Have you ever seen the video of the monkey mom who's peeling a banana for her monkey baby, and she is meticulous about pulling the strings off?
I have.
She works and works and works.
I think my mom refused to do that. I need a monkey mom.
Yeah. I at some point along the way, I decided that I could eat the strings, and it wasn't going to be a big issue.
I like these green. And you know what? I may have told this on the show before, but I was in a green room once with no less than Rachel Ray, and she refused to eat the bananas because they were just ripe. She did not want a yellow banana. She wanted a green banana to get its strength.
I feel like a green banana, though, gets into your stomach and gives you a little bit of a more opportunity for a stomach ache.
It can't be so green that you get that kind of weird mouth coating like you've... Like you've eaten alum in a Tom and Jerry cartoon and your mouth is shrinking.
Now
you don't want that.
You're eating on the program, which is another thing we get letters.
Love.
The ASMR people and the like, I'm easily grossed out by things people are going to be super mad. That's why I'm going to keep talking while you chew so we don't have to listen to your banana voice.
So there are 1,000 varieties of banana.
That can't be true.
It is true, but well, cultivars. You know.
How many natural varieties of banana?
Oh, yeah. I'm sure some of them have been cultivated on purpose. But I know for a fact that this organic Producto de Peru banana I'm eating right now that I bought at Costco on the way to your house, I know what kind of banana this is. This is a Cavendish banana. And I know that not because I'm some kind of weirdo banana expert, but I know that because essentially every banana sold in the United States, which is $25 billion a year industry, is a Cavendish banana.
Huh?
Only 47% of bananas produced in the world are Cavendish, but 99% of the ones that get exported are Cavendish.
Cavendish sounds like such a like a foil for Scrooge McDuck. It just feels like a rich people name.
Does it sound like a rich British man?
It does.
Because it is, in fact, named after an extremely rich British man.
Aha!
The Cavendishes...
Boy.
Now I should swallow, huh?
This chewing is real. We're going to get letters. We should put a trigger alert at the beginning.
We're
going to
get happy letters from all the ASMR people.
Do they like chewing? I thought they just liked it when I talked like this.
Why won't Ken eat a banana into a microphone?
One of the things that they like is a lot of kind of spit.
Yeah, that's what I do when I eat a banana.
No, what you do is...
That's just more of the good thing, then. The ASMR people should just love that even more. It's like... But it's a little louder.
I'm not sure that ASMR is about more.
It's about quantity, not quality. The Cavendishes were one of the leading families of 18th and 19th century Britain. They were Dukes of Devonshire. William Cavendish, the man the banana is named after, was called the Bachelor Duke.
Oh, wow. I wish I had. Don't you wish you were called the
Bachelor Duke?
The Bachelor Duke? Come on.
Well, you're halfway there.
Well, yeah, but I mean, actually, I'm about a quarter of the way there because it's hard to describe me as a bachelor anymore. I'm living in a completely domesticated cage.
You have a daughter and a cat.
I have a daughter and a cat and a daughter's mother, and we all share a roof while my mid-century modern house undergoes what turns out to have been
a 10-year remodel.
A ridiculous amount of extra work.
But just think what a bachelor you'll be once you're in your new Don Draper mid-century
Duke.
Pad.
The Bachelor Duke.
That's what you'll be called.
It sounds like a Chrysler product too, a little bit. Like the Bachelor Duke sounds like a certain kind of engine block, or maybe
it could be like a cigarette, like an early 70s cigarette.
Yeah.
Come up to where the flavor is. Bachelor Dukes. I looked up the Bachelor Duke because I'm, you know, as soon as I see that, I'm like, oh, he's gay, you know?
Oh, sure. Sure.
Let's out William Cavendish as a queer icon.
Nice guy. Never married.
It appears that he was not. And according to the history, he was put off of marriage forever by his upbringing. He was the son of the 5th Duke of Devonshire, also named William Cavendish, and Georgiana Spencer, one of the most famous figures.
Of the Spencer clan that produced Diana?
Oh, probably.
Yeah, almost certainly.
That's true. It turns out there's a movie about their lively, scandalous marriage, it turns out, called The Duchess with Keira Knightley. I know you love Keira Knightley period pieces. Did you see this?
I do. Any costume drama where people are speaking in received pronunciation,
I just want a movie where I can watch Ralph Fiennes' hairline recede over the course of the movie.
Somebody does a supercut of Ralph Fiennes' hairline receding throughout his films?
They have to shoot all his movies in order now, because if they actually shoot them out of sequence, you could see his hairline go up and down.
Have I seen The Duchess? I don't know. Maybe. It feels like a thing I might
have seen. It's based on the marriage of William Cavendish Sr. and Georgiana Spencer, which it turned out was full of radical politics because they were abolitionist Whigs.
Right.
And they were probably wearing abolitionist wigs. And they were also, I guess they had gambling problems, so lots of lively games of chance.
Love it.
But especially—
Did they squander their fortune?
No.
Oh.
As we'll see, William Jr. inherited an enormous banana-providing fortune. But they did, one of the things they used their money on were just a variety of sexual perversities.
Yes.
Including
these are the Bachelor Duke's parents.
Yes,
this is the kind of stuff swinging Dukes.
This is the house he grew up in that made him want to be the Bachelor Duke because of all the key parties he had to sit through. I guess his dad took a mistress who was also one of the Georgiana Spencer was one of the most famous kind of artistic women of the time.
Hello,
she had salons with musicians and thinkers, and Gainsborough painted her, and Reynolds painted her, and
sure.
Maybe she was on the stage. I don't know, but her husband. Despite having steak at home, also carried on a decade-long affair with Lady Elizabeth Foster. But it was okay because his wife was also super hot for Bess Foster.
Oh.
So they turned into the most famous polyamorous stately home in all of England.
And now I have to see Bess Foster if she's inspiring all this kind of situation.
Well, you're not going to know from a... This is like
maybe she was painted by Gainsborough.
Yeah, but they're all just going to look like, you know how they all, you know, all of Gainsborough's women's. I saw this basically.
All his women's.
Well, all these portraits just look like whatever people thought a face looked like in 1774.
Right,
you know?
No, but no, I'm afraid not. She looks like Sean Young in No Way Out. Are you kidding? Oh, no, wait. I think that might be Elizabeth Cavendish.
Oh, no, that's her. So after Georgiana's death.
Oh, I see.
The fifth Duke comforted himself by marrying his longtime mistress and then keeping another mistress. I believe he had several illegitimate children as well.
She does look like Sean Young. Except
with a
white fright wig.
She's wearing a wig.
Wow, what a bunch of hotties all these people are.
Do you think there was an equivalent of the limo scene, but in some kind of hansom carriage or trilby? Oh, no, that's a hat. What are different kinds of carriages?
Oh, you're thinking of a
coach and four.
Yeah, or what is it? It's a hansom,
a brougham.
A brougham, right. A surrey with a fringe on top.
Yeah, they were in a surrey with a fringe on top, and you lower the fringe so you can get it off.
Well, no, except the fringe was her fringe, if you know what I'm saying. This is peak upstairs, downstairs, too. So I'm sure that Cavendish was also having it off,
as they say,
with all of the housemaidens and whatnot.
I would have to assume. I don't want to stereotype, the Dukes of Devonshire.
My goodness.
But
Bess Foster.
So as a result of this, the kind of freewheeling, free love he grew up in, I think that is part of what made William Cavendish a bachelor duke who is way more interested in horticulture.
I do not understand this because it seems to me that if you were going to,
if you grew up with hot women in lace dresses,
and you were in an opportunity where you could have like an ongoing threesome, this seems like an advertisement for.
Well, I'm not saying marriage. He was ace. I mean, maybe he was just skeptical about marriage. Maybe he also, you know, moved through every beautiful woman in Derbyshire. I'm not sure.
I'm certainly skeptical of marriage.
I mean, he was one of the most powerful men in England at the time. So that would definitely, you know, given what I know about modern politicians and power and potassium and mm-hmm. Epstein's, mm-hmm. like I'm sure he was cutting a swath.
Yeah.
He was on the King's Privy Council. This is kind of late Hanover. So George IV, William IV-ish. He was the Lord Chamberlain of the Royal Household.
Oh.
Which I'm sure today is just some do-nothing, doddering old peer whose dad did a favor for somebody. But I'm sure at the time
he emptied all the bedpans.
Oh, I'm sure it's Lord more like schedules and
rattling gold chains at people,
personal assistant type duties. But at the time, you know, he's essentially chief of staff for the leader of the free world. He was later ambassador to Russia. But what he really loved was gardening. When the fifth Duke died, he inherited 8 beautiful stately homes all over the English countryside, 200,000 acres of land.
Where did the original fortune come from? Just being rich? Richness begats richness?
Well, I want to say slavery.
Right, of course. Because
it seems like that's almost always the answer.
That's the number one answer. How did
old white people get rich?
But in fact,
their fortune, they were one of the wealthiest British families, well, back to the 16th century.
So it's just lands and peasantry working the lands, growing whatever, strawberries, boysenberries.
Sir William Cavendish, the 16th century courtier, was Chancellor of the Exchequer or ran the Exchequer.
Oh, and so he's just printing money, literally.
Yeah, you can literally basically extort all the money you want out of yourself. And he was in a position to really profit from Thomas Cromwell's dissolution of the monasteries.
Sure, they took all the gold and beads and yes. and gems.
So instead of, it's better than slavery. It was rich hoarding monks. They're not likable, right? Nobody's writing some Roots of the Next Generation about rich hoarding monks.
The wonderful thing about English Protestantism is they got to take all the wealth from the Catholics and then they just invented Catholicism again. Episcopalianism or the Church of England is just Catholicism without the jewels.
Yeah, they have candles. I think some of them even have incense.
Yeah,
they just wanted divorces.
They wanted divorces and they wanted all that monkish gold, if you know what I mean.
I mean, if you had the choice of reporting to some boss in Canterbury or reporting to some boss in Italy. Like and back then that seems a little disreputable to have to go all the way to Mediterranean swarthy Italy to get your indulgences.
I would prefer to report to a boss in Italy just because of what I know about the Italian work ethic. I feel like, you know, a Cambridge boss is going to be like, I say, what is this?
Well, plus he's way over in Italy. Yeah. Like he can't micromanage you.
No, you send him a scroll.
Just get all the divorces you want and then tell him later, oh, we worked it all out, Your Holiness.
Your Holiness.
The sixth Duke, William Cavendish, did with all his lands is he planted things on them. He was a gardener. That's how you know he was asexual, I think, because he was a gardener.
I am a gardener.
Oh, sorry. And I did not mean to offend.
I have no offense taken. I am a quarantine gardener.
You just slash things back. You're a Brazilian coffee planter.
There are a lot of different.
What have you actually planted?
I'm planting a lot of things. In fact, I have 9 fir tree starters in little pots.
Concealed about your person.
That I am, I'm about, there's tiny little pockets. No, I'm about, I'm putting them out on the grounds. You know, a fir tree, of course, gets to be a large thing, but.
It does.
But by the time.
We had three right by our house when we moved in that somebody had thought would be good for moving the house.
Are they not there now?
We moved them immediately. Why would you want a Douglas fir 6 feet from here?
I have Douglas firs on my property that are 150 feet high. Huge, you know, old, second growth.
Love right? them. And the tree that hulas.
So I have these tiny ones, and it's wonderful to plant a thing that you know will not be mature until after you are gone. Unless there's some kind of longevity pill that Elon Musk derives and I'm rich enough to buy.
It's a gift you're giving posterity.
That's right. Eventually, someday, someone will stand and look at that tree and go,
someday somebody's going to make you want to turn around and say goodbye.
Yeah, but that happens all the time.
But you'll still have a fir tree.
Someday, someway. Oh. Someday, someway.
We planted the Douglas fir tree that was too close to our previous house. We moved back to the fence line to replace put it near a stump where somebody had cut down a Douglas fir. Yeah, it was small enough to move. And by the time we moved from that house, like those things grow pretty fast, especially when little. It was, it started out up to my knees, and by the time we left, it was taller than any of us.
Well, that's great. That's wonderful news.
And we put a little shrine out there to our late dog.
Aww.
He's not buried there, but a collar and a leash and toys are buried out there. So, my daughter could visit the tree,
which she liked. I buried my cat, Lewis, under a rhododendron starter. And
speaking of things that get huge.
That rhododendron now is 8 feet around, and I used to go out and pay tribute to Lewis.
That symbolizes Lewis's broadening consciousness, expanding Lewis, through the universe.
Lewis has become perennial.
Well, literally. Well, I feel bad to say that you're just a pruner, because you are also a planter.
I am, and I planted at my old farm. I planted an entire garden, but I am not a flower gardener. I am a shrub gardener.
Can I recommend to you?
Yes.
Herbs. I have an herb garden that I love because it feels useful and not decorative. It's still beautiful.
Right.
It can still be trimmed to interesting shapes and sizes, but you can also, if you need really any herb except dill, which I cannot get to grow this year, you can go out and get the tarragon or the cilantro you desire.
Here is the thing, though. I'm not a super taster, but I am a sensitive taster, and my tolerance for many herbs is low. There's almost no instance where I want dill on a thing.
Well, you should come to our house because my dill died.
So my herb garden would be like parsley, sage. Not even sage. I don't want sage or rosemary or thyme. My thing would just be parsley.
Parsley, 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 and parsley.
And, like Vietnamese basil, maybe, could grow. But other than that, it all smells like dirt to me. Tastes like dirt.
Sage, we have quite a bit of sage because those herbs will just grow like crazy. And it does kind of smell like sweat socks,
yeah,
it turns out.
Yeah, and I don't want it. I don't want it in my chicken. Ken... I just want to interrupt the show for a second and say how important it's been for us that our listeners support us on our Patreon. It's been personally it's relieved me of a lot of anxiety personally.
It did not look like Omnibus was going to continue at our former corporate home.
That's right. I enjoy the show so much. I enjoy your company so much and doing the show here. And
you know, I'll only hang out with you if I'm being well paid.
That's right. And for a full year, we made the show under the cloud of, what felt like a lot of duress and stress.
And pretty much doing it at a loss.
Yeah, no real compensation, all this sort of promise of some magical future that never came to pass.
Until we decided to rely upon the goodwill of listeners.
That's right. We left our corporate masters and appealed to you directly, listeners, and the outpouring of support it buoyed us so much. Ken and I stopped sending each other testy texts in the middle of the night saying, if it weren't for you, Ken, these corporate overlords would be paying me a fortune. And he would reply, I made you! Five exclamation points.
Now that it's been about a year since we've been a listener-supported podcast, we just wanted to let you know that if you are a supporter of Omnibus, all the rewards and benefits that come with that do renew every year.
Mm-hmm.
So... you know, this is a uncharted territory for us. We now have people that have been supporting the show for well over a year. And just so you know, your bonus monthly bonus episodes and access to the image feed will continue. But if you received a signed copy of show notes last year, that's going to happen again this year.
Nice. Probably
accompanied by a signed chick tract, because we didn't know why anyone would want a second set of show notes. It's a little anticlimactic after you have your first one.
I don't know. These are pretty good show notes over here. Look at this one.
But they're going to come with a chick tract this year,
yeah,
autographed. If you have suggested a show topic and you're still donating at that tier, you can suggest a new show in 2021. If you did a live chat with us in 2020, there will be another one of those in 2021 if you keep donating. So thank you for your continued support.
Thank you so much. And continuing to do this show is really, it's a bright spot in my week. To see Ken's shining face over there looking at his phone while I'm talking.
And if this cursed year has allowed you the financial wherewithal to become an Omnibus supporter and you are not yet, this is your chance to sample all of these wonders and delights for the first time.
Thanks for your support. Patreon.com/Omnibus Project.
Mr. Cavendish, Duke of Devonshire, liked showy plants. He liked, you know, back then the vogue was for tropical things that had been brought back. So he built a big glass house at his Chatsworth home outside of Derbyshire, outside of London. And it was actually the model for the Crystal Palace
that was
later built in, Hyde Park or wherever.
Yeah, I wonder. So this was the era of the hothouse, right? We talked about this in Fern Fever.
And if you've ever been to Kew Gardens outside of London, that was actually his project. He wanted a botanical garden that had, you know, the vast variety of plants to be found in the empire, including these huge hothouses that are full of ginormous ferns and coffee and amazing tropical blooms that you can still see at Kew.
This is why we can't tax the rich.
Because they will not give us giant hothouses full of beans.
Who's going to build Kew Gardens? The Revolutionary People's Party?
If I want to see a pineapple growing in situ,
right?
Well, I could fly to Tonga. But if we have the rich, I can just visit one of their hothouses on the one day a year they allow public entry.
Thank you.
In 1834, the Duke happened to receive as a gift from a chaplain friend who I guess had been to Mauritius or been stationed in Mauritius, a banana tree.
Uh-huh.
And we're going to get letters. The banana tree is not a tree. It's called a tree agriculturally.
A banana tree is not a tree, and a banana is not a banana.
It's not a tree at all.
It's a fruit.
A banana is a berry, and it's not a tree because it's not woody. It's huge, but it's a succulent stem. It's an herb.
Oh, nice.
You could have bananas in your herb garden, except that you only want parsley.
You could have bananas in your herb garden.
Mm-hmm. Oh, is that a euphemism for you?
Yeah, but they're just right under the fringe.
Hey, you up? I wanna bring some bananas to your herb garden. And so it looks like a tree because I think it's the biggest herb. It's the tallest succulent plant there is.
But now it's an herb that produces a berry. Is that true of any other herbs?
Oh, I think herb is a general term. I mean, the culinary herbs are a
herbaceous.
Much smaller set. Yes, it's herbaceous in that it's got a succulent stem, which just means squishy and full of liquid and not woody.
I grow succulents actually in my garden.
I love succulents. They're hard to kill, which is what I like about them.
That's what I like too.
Water these once a month.
And every
spring, if you think of it,
they send up some weird prehistoric shoot.
Oh, you got the hen and chicks.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I don't like those actually. I don't like when the hen gets all, you're a hen. Like we do not need your protuberances erecting from my yard.
But then
my rockery.
Then the chicks proliferate.
I do love when the chicks come out, but I just don't think the hen needs
when the chicks come out.
The hen should it brings all the chicks to the yard. But I just don't want the hen to be fertilizing her own chicks in the way they seem to do. It's a little graphic.
I see what you're saying.
I want a good Protestant succulent garden where I don't have to see things pollinate themselves.
Right, I get it.
So from this one plant that it was called the Cavendish banana because some Mauritius visitor from the Indian Ocean brought it to his hothouses where it proliferated. And from thence, it moved on to the Canary Islands, and from there to the Caribbean, to Africa. From Africa, it spread to Madagascar and then to Southeast Asia. So, it's possible that this is a banana that had been to some of these places from its tropical home. But it seems like, in general, it came to England.
Sure.
To the Cavendish grounds and then spread from there.
Now, was it Cavendish himself who was propagating these bananas on plantations, or was some visitor came to the Cavendish house and was like, I say that, let me take a cutting.
Cuttings and clippings, and he didn't do it. You know, he had Joseph Paxton, the greatest horticulturalist of his time, on salary. So I don't know how much of this the Duke actually did hands-on. Maybe he just walked through the orangery once a week and said, looking smashing. Joseph, absolutely. Paxton, absolutely smashing.
But this was the era where the colonialization of the world sort of produced this the initial global crop, not just market, but like the idea that that you could take coffee from its origin point and grow it anywhere, that it was that the tropical conditions were right, and there was enough of an international sort of marketplace.
And that's what happened here. It just wasn't Cavendish doing it. It was other plantation owners realizing, hey, like, let me clear some land in Borneo or Burma or whatever, and we'll try these here. And
Monsanto really got ahead of that in contemporary times, because they copyrighted all their genetically modified corn and whatnot.
GMO is a huge part of the story of the Cavendish banana, as we shall see. Because right now, you know, in the northern... So I said that essentially all bananas you will see at the store, you know, unless you're at some little market in Cambodia, will be Cavendish bananas, which make up essentially all of the world's export bananas. And, you know, the northern hemisphere now has an appetite for tens of billions of bananas every year.
What are people doing with all these bananas?
Well, I hope they're eating them and not doing weird Richard Gere things with them.
The thing is, I love banana bread, for instance, and I don't get anywhere near as much of it as I want.
Are you saying I need to make you banana bread?
If you would.
I brought you muffins.
You did bring muffins, which feel very banana bread-like, but I love bananas. We eat about 6 of them a week here.
If you eat fewer bananas, they start to turn brown and then black, and then you can say, oh, I'll put these in the freezer and make banana bread out of them, and then you never will.
I have some black bananas in the freezer. I will never do anything with them except they just take up space in the freezer.
This seems like a John problem. This seems like something you need to work on, not a Ken problem. I need to bring you. I don't need to bring you banana bread. You've got all the makings.
No, I'm not saying you need to bring me banana bread. You can come over here and make it.
So the convenience of them means we feel like, even though they're not from our part of the world,
right,
we now feel entitled to this supply chain. By Absolutely. We, I mean just like Western cold weather people.
All 52 weeks of the year too, I want access to cheap bananas.
Thank you, Southern Hemisphere, Producto de Peru. And it seems like this must be a very stable supply chain, just because every time you go to the store, there's countless bananas.
Yeah, they never run out.
In fact, it is a very precarious supply chain, and it depends on...
Because it's a monoculture, or for other reasons?
Well, because of the sheer volume of bananas that the Northern Hemisphere wants, we are really stretching the demands of what the environment and the shipping chains, the shipping routes can deliver to us. And so we need efficiencies, and one of those efficiencies is essentially a monoculture. The Cavendish banana is perfect for a world that needs a ton of bananas, because it's the perfect banana to grow in a lot of ways, even though it kind of has, if you've ever tried one of these other artisanal bananas, it has a bland taste. You know, there are bananas that taste like ice cream. There are bananas that are weird colors.
Yeah.
And yet we're kind of eating these boring ones for a few reasons. First of all, the plants tend to be short, but fruitful. And short is good because...
It's hard to harvest bananas.
Exactly. You need fewer ladders and or shorter workers.
Mm-hmm.
Also, a lot of these bananas grow in stormy parts of the world, and shorter trees are more hurricane resistant.
Right.
They're easy to spray. You know, pesticides are super important to keep the Northern Hemisphere in its 50 billion bananas every year or whatever it is. So you want trees that are low enough that you can spray them easily. The Cavendish produces a ton of bananas per plant. And it's also a weird genetic oddity. The Cavendish banana is sterile. It has 3 copies of each chromosome.
Huh.
So the only way it can reproduce is clonally, kind of like your hens and chicks, I guess. And I guess that means it really scales well. It's a super predictable plant. You know exactly how many you're going to get off of each tree. You know exactly how long it's going to get to grow a new tree from that cutting. You know how long they're going to take to ripen in a shipping. Did you know bananas do a thing where their ripening is contagious?
Whoa.
Like when one banana ripens, it sprays a bunch of ethene.
I do feel that
it
way.
It exudes it.
And I feel like it is contagious to other fruits as well. If you put a banana in with with your other fruits, it will cause them to ripen faster.
I think that might be true. Because I think it's not the only species that uses ethene as a signal.
So bananas I'll sometimes put into the refrigerator to like slow their roll.
Yes.
They're like the Mandalorians of fruits.
In what way? Because you never unpeel them and see their face?
Yeah, they're clones and they're covered with Mandalorian steel and they cause other things to ripen.
Does the Mandalorian cause other things?
Sure, look Baby at Baby Yoda.
Look how well he's doing.
He's ripening throughout that whole show.
So the uniformity of a monoculture just makes bananas in that scale both workable and profitable, which you couldn't do if you were growing these little weird purple things that tasted amazing, but wouldn't make it back to Ontario or wherever they're going.
In all your travels, because I know you lived in Central America for a while, have you ever had
I never lived in Central America.
I know that you lived in Peru and Colombia.
I shipped Arms to the Contras for many years.
In the mid-80s. Flying a DC-3 in a Hawaiian shirt with sunglasses and a cheroot.
That's exactly right.
Have you ever had a tree-ripened banana?
I don't know if my love of kind of hard green bananas means that when I'm in one of these exotic places and I see these beautiful purple bananas sitting under a shady tree by a guy who's also selling guavas, I do not think, man, I got to try that.
Right.
I just get the guava.
Even though it tastes like ice cream?
Have you tried one of these amazing bananas?
Yeah. At a certain point, they seem less like bananas and more like a potato almost. Tasty, but...
They're not goopier? I imagined that a lot of these would be goopier.
Well, I think
we're getting firmer bananas here because they hold up in shipping holds.
They are goopier, but I think of potatoes as goopy.
Oh, you don't like potatoes.
I don't like potatoes. So, I mean, it's not like eating a potato like an apple where it's like crunchy. It's like a mushy potato.
I like plantains. Like if I get a Cuban sandwich, okay. I love to have some nice starchy potato-y bananas.
I think it's the... For whatever reason, although bananas are pure starch, when I look at a Cavendish banana, I don't think of it as starchy. I think of it as sweet.
It is sweet.
And then there are, but the bigger, the purpler bananas, I don't know. I feel the starch more.
It's more like a breadfruit vibe.
Even though the taste is, I guess better.
So we talked about the skin of the Cavendish. It actually has a thinner skin than, your grandpa's banana, which was the Gros Michel before 1965.
How do you know about my grandpa's banana?
Well, I'm not going to say your grandpa showed me his banana. But everybody's grandpa had the same banana before 1965. When you went to what's a good 60s era grocery store, the A&P
Wiggly Piggly.
When you went to the, there's no way it's the Wiggly Piggly.
Piggly Wiggly.
When you went to the Piggly Wiggly, except that's just regional. That's a modern grocery store. If you live in Alabama, the Tradewell.
A&P, let's call it that.
The Savewell. Anyway, you went to your 1950s or 60s grocer, you would get the Gros Michel, which actually tasted better than the Cavendish banana, and it had a thicker skin, so it would hold up really well to shipping.
Now, wait a minute. If Cavendish bananas have been proliferating around the world since the 19th century, why were we eating Gros Michels as late as the 50s?
Because they're better. Everybody knew that they could grow a Cavendish. They had it in their back pocket. But all the fruit, the Standard Fruit Company and United Fruit Company, they all
were CIA preferred fronts.
The Gros Michel. I mean, that's one thing about the history of bananas is the reason why we still say Banana Republic to refer to a certain kind of developing world nation is because of U.S. interference in these little countries that we only cared about because massive fruit conglomerates had financial interests there.
Right.
So we would just install the Honduran dictator of our choice who would keep the bananas flowing.
Every time you eat a banana, you are complicit in CIA destabilizing of Central America.
Still?
Yeah.
There's no sundown clause on that?
I mean, the thing is, are you complicit in slavery sitting in America today? You could argue yes.
I guess that's true. I mean, it really makes me not want to wear cotton shirts, for example.
Well, that's the problem. Do you have leather shoes on? You're part of the problem.
But the reason why we don't eat the Gros Michel anymore is because they all died.
What?
Starting around 1890, a fungus called, a fusarium fungus called TR1, which is just, I think, Tropical Race 1. It's just how scientists designated this
Oh, I thought it was a human cyborg that came back through a time portal
and killed all the bananas. Uh-huh. Oh, no, it's a TR. And then the TR-1000 came through and killed the TR-1.
A-hole.
And this caused what was called the Panama disease, just this terrible blight where whole plantations died. As soon as it got in the soil, it was done for. And the plantation owners weren't worried because they had plan B. They had
Cavendish.
A Cavendish banana in their back pocket, or maybe they were just happy to see me. I don't know. But so between 1940 and 1960, all the big fruit companies, Standard Fruit, United Fruit, and by the way, these companies are still around. We think of these as CIA fronts and relics, but no, they just changed their name to Dole and Chiquita.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Are those the same companies?
Yeah, those are all.
Oh, no. I had no idea.
It's got a cute dancer now, but that is the United Fruit Company.
Did they change the name of Air America to something else too? Like, is it just called United Airlines now?
They made Air America that, that short-lived, liberal talk radio station with Janine Garofalo. And that was worse than anything that the real Air America had done. So
boy. Its own Vietnam.
So by 1965, Dole and Chiquita had switched to their backup banana, and we've been eating nothing but Cavendish bananas for the last 50 years.
Now, is the Gros Michel gone from the world, or are there little pockets of them still available?
Oh, I think you could still, I think cultivars were saved. You could still grow a Gros Michel. You just can't do it at scale because there's no way to, once this stuff is in the soil, it lives there forever. It's totally pesticide proof.
Wow.
And it just chokes out the plant. It moves up through the roots and just keeps the plant from absorbing any water or nutrients.
It's a weird.
So in a matter of months, it's gone.
It's a kind of salting of the earth.
It is. You cannot use that soil for anything ever again.
What? You can't grow wheat there? You can't grow dope there?
Your kids can make mud pies, maybe?
You can grow dope pretty much anywhere.
Yeah, I'm guessing there are plants that are more resilient than the Gros Michel.
Right.
Because this was, the TR1 was specific to the Gros Michel, and the Cavendish banana was immune to it.
Wow.
So they could use these plantations still for bananas. They didn't have to divest themselves of all their land. They just had to switch to a slightly less tasty banana. And so that's why we've been eating the Cavendish for the last 50 years.
I feel like this is the work of God.
God did not want us eating delicious bananas?
God was like, these bananas are too tasty. And people have to suffer a little privation here.
It's too sensual a pleasure to eat a delicious creamy banana.
Yeah, it's a little bit of imposed hair shirt.
That's why I eat these green pasty ones. I don't feel like I deserve nice things.
They're not as sensual. They're not as luscious.
That's right.
Yeah.
Except they're still. I mean, they're harder and they're hard cylindrical things. So maybe that's worse. Maybe that's sensual in a different way.
They're kind of the starched button down short sleeve shirt with a pocket protector in it of fruit.
That's why the CIA was so into protecting bananas. It's totally their ethos. So I thought you meant that God would just be against installing right wing dictatorships.
Are you kidding? God is 100% down with those.
That's good to know. So the story would end there with everybody happily eating Cavendish bananas, except that around 1990, plant pathologists in Florida started seeing under their microscopes a new little fusarium fungus.
TR2.
Ooh, it's even worse. It's TR4.
TR4? What happened to 2 and 3?
It's so bad they skipped TR2 and 3.
TR4?
TR2 and 3 are like, the operating systems you never use, or like the unsuccessful Windows version. So you have to skip from 7 to 10.
Right, it's the Mac Lisa.
It was TR1, then it was Vista, then it was Lisa, then it was TR4.
Windows 95.
Right. So in Indonesia and Malaysia, they start to see this new fungus living in the soil. And unfortunately, this one is incredibly toxic to the Cavendish banana.
Oh, no.
The Cavendish banana does not stand a new chance against these little fungi. Wait.
We eat too many bananas for this bad news.
This is really bad news. By 2013, they've arrived in Mozambique, probably on the boots or in the equipment of some of the workers who have come from Southeast Asia. This Fusarium TR4 is an invasive species. And since then, we have just watched it spread throughout the banana-producing belt of the world. Lebanon, Israel, India, Jordan, Oman, Pakistan, a country that starts with A that I can't read. Australia. Uh-huh. And as I've said, when...
Wait, they grow bananas in Oman? I don't think of it as like...
Oman is a massive banana. You thought it was a desert. It's just a massive banana plantation.
I did not think that they were growing bananas there. Wow.
Okay. My guess is there's very limited banana growth in some of these places. But I don't know.
I mean, there's a lot going on in Oman. There's mountains
and
stuff.
It's a land of contrast.
Yeah.
But when TR4 sweeps through these plantations, it just looks like you've used Roundup. You know, it just kills everything. And it's not just like Dutch elm disease where stuff starts to wither. Like, everything's just black and gone.
Oh, no.
And the situation right now, and we're recording, Futurelings, we're recording this in the year 2020. You are probably from a Cavendish-free future. We're recording this in the year 2020, where the situation is already worse than Panama disease was in the 40s and 50s when Dole and Chiquita started switching away from Gros Michel.
Really?
Yeah. And it's worse, not just in that it's more widespread, but also in that we have no backup.
We have no bananas?
We have no backup bananas today. So everyone's just kind of holding their breath, waiting for it to get to Central America. And for many years, the assumption was it's already there and it's being covered up.
Oh.
Nobody wants to say stop dealing with us because we're the tainted country or we're the tainted coastal district.
Are you saying that the global banana cultivation is no longer global? It's just only in Central America, and that's our last stopgap?
No, but, bananas are still growing in these other places, but, to a lesser degree as the blight spreads.
I see.
And actually, Australia, the name I could not read on my list of countries, actually is one of the first places that's looking for a Cavendish solution. If Cavendishes do exist in your future, sentient banana eaters, if you're sentient bananas, all bets are off. This is family history for you.
Mm-hmm.
Australia has less restrictive GMO laws than the European Union.
Is that right? I would have thought the opposite, but
oh, okay. You mean because of the invasive species thing there?
Yeah.
I guess you've still got that convict culture, we'll eat anything, we'll eat crocodiles and emus vibe of the outback, right?
Sure.
Like, they're not going to be troubled by a few genes from a rhubarb making its way into their bananas or some bacterial DNA making its way into their fruit.
Right.
They're a hardy people. They're not wimps like us.
Right, no.
There's a Queensland scientist named James Dale, who is kind of the world's leading Frankenstein banana producer. He made headlines for the golden banana, which was his dream. What if, you've got all these countries that eat a ton of bananas, and you've got all these countries that have vitamin A deficiencies, and a lot of them are the same countries.
Ah.
So what if you could just trick people? It's like when Upper West Side moms make their kids eat kale by putting, it's like the only thing these kids eat is smoothies. If I can somehow sneak a little bit of snap peas into their smoothie, I could pretend they had a vegetable today.
Right. Sure.
So if you could,
ketchup
if
is
you
a
could,
vegetable,
if you could sneak a little, what's that?
Ketchup is technically a
sure,
vegetable.
I'll just put a little ketchup in their smoothie, or on their dinosaur chicken nuggets. So if, it's the same thing. This guy's like, if you could sneak a little vitamin A into the plants these people are eating anyway, they wouldn't have to change their diets
right.
or get supplements. So he invented the golden banana with money from the Gates Foundation. He invented the golden banana, which is this bright orange banana, which I guess it's metaphorically gold because it has a day's worth of vitamin A in it.
Full of gold.
It's full of sweet, sweet supplement gold.
How do you get vitamin A otherwise?
From Flintstone vitamins?
Right. But other than that, somewhere in nature, how are people who are full of vitamin A getting that vitamin A?
What are you and I eating that Uganda is not getting enough of?
Yes.
Eggs.
Okay.
Delicious
steak.
Vegetables. Like it's like your yellow and green vegetables.
Oh,
broccoli,
I see.
Spinach.
Right.
Cod liver oil if you're an Edwardian child who is misbehaved.
Drink a gallon of it a week. Put it in everything.
So among James Dale's banana projects, he is producing gene-edited versions of the Cavendish. And in fact, he has done this. He's put wild banana genes into the sequence of a Cavendish banana, and he's produced TR4-resistant bananas.
Really?
Yes.
That are also full of vitamin A.
I don't know if he's combined his two interests, but he should. Would it kill him?
Uh-huh. He's the banana king of the 21st century.
So Australia can be enjoying these loosely regulated GMO bananas.
Oh, but Europe won't allow it.
Europe will not allow it.
But the United States is pretty loosey-goosey about that stuff.
He's found a loophole in the United States. I guess the current USDA standard is that if you jiggle the genes just in a way that nature could do,
they'll stop running.
like the USDA allowed a GMO mushroom that had been had a few genes of a mushroom that didn't get as brown, so that your mushroom looks nice and white in the produce aisle.
Sure.
And the USDA ruling was, this is the kind of slight coloration difference you could get just by doing a few generations of crossbreeding. These guys just did it quicker, therefore we're going to allow it.
And so anything and Dr. that Dale seems said, Mendelian would pass.
Yeah. But I don't know how you, what's the bright line there? Eh, this looks vaguely like something a weird boysenberry farmer could do.
I think if it's a machine.
If it doesn't have eyes.
Right. I think that that probably disqualifies it.
If the fruit hasn't grown mucous membranes, it's okay. So anyway, so Dr. Dale thinks there is a possibility where, you know, he can get the amount of bacterial DNA he's using low enough to, and there are projects like this going all over the world, you know, because these Central American countries know that their livelihood depends on this in the same way that Kuwait is terrified of running out of oil. Honduras is terrified of TR4. So a ton of global money in the third world and the developing world and elsewhere is going into a building a better Cavendish banana. But if it doesn't, mark my words, its days are numbered. You know, the days of the abundant Cavendish banana in your grocery store may be gone, and we don't know what we could replace it with.
And this is a thing where you'll just one day start going to the grocery store and bananas are more and more expensive and fewer and fewer. And then one day there are no bananas. Are there precedents for this?
Well, this stuff tends to be underreported. I mean, you know, there were 60 Minutes pieces on Dutch elm disease,
right?
But we now live in a world where all the, you know, and for decades, we've lived in a world where all the chestnut trees and all the elm trees died. And people who were into that culture were like,
guess we stopped roasting chestnuts over an open fire.
Yeah. But the rest of us are just like, oh really? Chestnut trees?
Right.
No, I'm sure we've got, that's wrong. We got to have, you know, people just weren't aware.
During our childhood, we watched apples get bad, and then there were almost no varieties of apples. And then in recent years, there have been all these wonderful varietals.
We were tricked into eating apples that looked good and red and waxy and shiny, even though they were just like sawdust on the inside.
I'm always stunned when someone, because it still happens, that someone will show up with a Red Delicious, take a bite out of it and go, this apple's terrible. And I'm like, do you not know not to buy Red Delicious? I mean, they look delicious, but they're not. You buy a, you know, you buy one of these.
Are you buying these for a 1958 school teacher?
Yeah, what?
Because if not, why do these exist?
But there have been all these great apples that have kind of come on the scene in the last 20 years that for, you know, for a lot of the 1980s, it seemed like all apples were bad and apples had just been ruined.
Your Fuji, your Honeycrisp.
I wonder
your
if.
Your Gala, your Pink Lady.
Yeah, the right. All of those are wonderful. I wonder if it will be part of like foodie culture that we start to develop tastes for other kinds of plantains and purple mealy ones.
I wonder how long it'll be, you know, cause right now the banana is your platonic ideal of a yellow thing, you know,
right.
Like it's Velvet Underground Records and, you know, the look of the banana is so important to its brand. And to this day, when you tell somebody to draw an apple, They will draw a banana because they have a terrible Oliver Sacks nerve ailment.
Wait a minute. Is this one of those things where I think it's a banana, but it's really an apple this whole time?
They will draw a Red Delicious. You know what I'm saying? Like if you're playing Pictionary, you tell somebody to draw an apple, they will draw a bright red thing with the kind of the two bulbs of a Red Delicious, you know?
Right. Even though we don't
eat Even though no anymore. One would eat anything that looked like that. Like how long before somebody just draws a Fuji, you know? And maybe it's the same thing with bananas. Maybe somebody listening to this episode in 1,000 years thinks of bananas as a purple spiky oblong.
Right.
And they think it's crazy that we ever used to eat these weird big yellow string beans.
Maybe all bananas will look like that peeled banana meme, banana meme. What are you looking at?
I was going to see if you still have a peeled banana sitting in front of you.
Well, I do. I have a peel here and I have a banana here. I moved the banana over to the muffin plate because I wanted to protect it.
I've always said you had a peel.
And that concludes, on a terrible note, the Cavendish banana. Entry 197.JU0112, certificate number 26039, in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that you are bananas, well, wait a minute. I feel like I'm kind of bananas. You are almost
all bananas these days.
Yeah, you're almost certainly bananas for listening to this show. But in the unlikely event that social media still exists in your era, which is a total banana farm, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram are archived at Omnibus Project. You can find Ken Jennings and myself under our names at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick.
But it's the other way around.
You can find
I'm at John Roderick.
You can find at Ken Jennings is me at John Roderick. He's taking over my Twitter feed, and he'll see what it's like to get only 50 faves.
This is good. I do it. It's like the Prince and the Pauper. I do this once a year, like Henry V mingling with his troops just to keep me humble.
I'm on Instagram, where I post pictures of my garden of brush,
and no herbs because you have sensory issues.
That's right. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can join one of our fan groups on Stitcher and TikTok and Reddit, Facebook,
Gleep,
all under the Futurelings heading. You can send us mail at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155, as long as the Postal Service remains an icon of American civilization. We will receive your mail.
We're speaking to a November populace that may or may not even have the post office.
No.
I feel bad. Like, I was going to put mail trucks on a omnibus shirt for the holiday season, but now are we just stealing merch dollars from the U.S. Postal Service? We can make donations.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not, though.
Let's say we will, and then just don't. See, this is why you can't tax the rich. They won't make fictional donations.
You seem to be opening some mail over there.
I'm opening mail right now. So it may be Tom. See, this one came directly from a vintage paper company, and I don't know if Tom had this Oregon vintage paper company send us this, or if Tom runs this Oregon company, but it's a...
What era?
1950s, maybe?
I believe I was communicating with Tom on the internet about this map.
It's a sightseeing map where you can take bus tours from downtown Seattle, 4th and University, although I wouldn't wait too long there.
Are you
going to
rip open the original packaging there? Is that what you're doing?
I don't think this is original packaging. I think they put this in saran wrap to mail it.
Are you sure about that?
I'm pretty sure because it's taped shut.
Oh. What, they didn't have tape in 1955? You just don't care at all.
I really... No, and I think they did this at Practically Perfect Paper Products.
Okay. Oh, they're in mint condition. Look
they
at those.
They really are lovely. And it's a bus tour that will take you... Well, there's two options. Here's one that goes all the way around to the east side.
For only $5.
Is that right? $5?
It says right on the back there, the only part of it that I can see as you monopolize this wonderful
thing.
Oh,
it's got Mount Rainier views, I see.
There's a marine tour, it looks like.
Yeah, look at the little boat tour you can take.
Oh, so it's put on by Gray Line, but it was when Gray Line was trying to diversify.
But he also sent us a U.S. National Park Service map of Mount Rainier National Park from 1938, and it's in beautiful condition.
Hip hop hooray.
This is lovely, Tom.
Oh, this is nice stuff here.
And then Alexander, this is very exciting. Alexander from Antelope, California, sent us a vintage magazine ad for a product I did not believe existed, but you did, the Bone Phone.
The Bone Phone!
Stereo sound you wear around. And it's got this kind of sketchy, early 80s graphic design illustration style that everyone loved back then.
it's taken, I think, from Leroy Neiman's paintings of the 1976 Olympics.
But what if instead of,
but it's like fencing
and basketball, it was just people listening to a weird skeletal vibration.
Oh, you know, there's a Nagel aspect to this bottom picture, but there, you know, this girl in the short shorts on roller skates with high knee socks is very much 1979, but look at the Nagel at the bottom.
Oh, wow. Yeah, look at her cheekbones. That's great.
Wow, that's wonderful. Stereo sound you wear around. The Bone Phone.
So now I do believe the Bone Phone exists. Thank you, Alexander.
Or this was an elaborate prank, but very elaborate.
Yeah, like, look, he really captured the style of the time.
The last thing I'd like to point out is that our show is partially, and by that I mean largely, supported by our Patreon donors. Your contributions have made our show possible and made it possible for us to be an independent production.
We're almost entirely supported by devoted listeners.
That's right.
Isn't that great? We still sell the occasional ad because we believe in capitalism at heart.
Yeah, that's right. Late-stage capitalists at heart because we're boomers. We're boomer adjacent. Gen X.
But the show nobody cares about only Gen X. Exactly, the invisible generation. The show is only a going concern because people like it enough to want to feel part of the community.
So if you'd like to contribute, if you've been listening to the show for a while and have listened this far into the outro, we're guessing that you are probably fans. And if that's so, and you want to support the show, you can go to patreon.com/omnibusproject.
We will put photos of the bone phone ad and the beautiful vintage maps on our Patreon. And you know what? If you're listening to this in November, if you become a new supporter right now, that means we have a full year of addenda shows that you can listen to. There's catalog of 12 bonus shows that you could just start spooling through right now to celebrate your new $5 supporter.
The bonus shows are wonderful because they are a venue where Omnibus listeners and futurelings of all stripes
can
write in and say, hey, you guys, I listened to this show about a topic that I got 2 PhDs in, and I noticed
I'm actually an expert.
You didn't mention this, like, 700th footnote in the book that I wrote about it, and we get to tease those people.
So this is the show you listen to if you want to hear somebody who just heard about a topic 40 minutes ago.
Right.
The addenda shows is the show you listen to for actual expertise.
Actual expertise. Mocked and reviled by us.
By lay people.
Who don't even remember having done this show.
Who are jealous of expertise. Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the banana catastrophe we fear may never come, that the Cavendish banana lives forever. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.